Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Trump's boast that now, after his tariff war made Mexico cry uncle, he would turn his attention to put the screws on China using his prowess as a dealmaker to win big. Michael Fuchs, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs and was Special Advisor to the Secretary of State for Strategic Dialogues and a member of the State Department's Policy Planning Staff, joins us to discuss the growing closeness of China and Russia, who in many ways Trump is driving together into an alliance against us. We'll examine how much foreign policy, which traditionally Americans have not paid much attention to, will be an issue in the 2020 campaign, and whether, given Trump's boorish and embarrassing behavior abroad, tweeting out insults and trashing a war hero at the hallowed ground where the heroes of D-Day are buried, will be a factor, in as much as there is an expectation the head of state displays some dignity that comes with the office. Then we'll speak with David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously a White House speechwriter and a special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee, who recently testified before the House Oversight Subcommittee on Economic and Consumer Policy about the for-profit college industry and how it has been empowered by the U.S. Department of Education under Secretary Betsy DeVos. He joins us to discuss the impact of John Dean's testimony yesterday before the House Judiciary Committee and, since there is no such thing as a deep state, which became clear when we learned Robert Mueller brought a pencil to a gunfight, we will assess what strategies can be employed to rid the country of the out-of-control man-child in the Oval Office. Then finally, we'll hear from an Israeli activist who believes in a one-state solution, not the one-state solution the Israeli right envisions by driving the Palestinians into a caged future in a diminished territory or into Jordan, but the creation of one democratic state with equal rights for Palestinians and Israelis. Miko Peled, the author of A General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, who has two articles at Mint Press News for the U.S. and Israel, Iran Works Best as a Perpetual Threat, and Netanyahu's Gambling on New Elections to Stay in Power, joins us. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Michael Fuchs, is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs and was Special Advisor to the Secretary of State for Strategic Dialogues. He also served as a member of the Secretary's Policy Planning Staff, where he worked on a diverse set of issues and initiatives, including the State Department's response to the Arab Spring, cybersecurity, and the development of a U.S. government strategy to prevent and respond to mass atrocities. And he co-authored The Survival and the Success of Liberty, A Democracy Agenda for U.S. Foreign Policy with Morton Halperin. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Fuchs.
It's great to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you. And there was a very successful bromance last week in St. Petersburg between President Xi of China and President Putin of Russia. It seems like they are moving together in much deeper cooperation than these two countries who are kind of traditional rivals, at the very least suspicious of each other. They seem to be cooperating, and in many ways, I recently spoke to Chaz Freeman, who translated between Nixon and Mao in 1972 in the opening to China. And he, of course, pointed out that Nixon's strategy was to put the U.S. in the catbird seat, being able to play the PRC off against the USSR. And now that situation has been reversed. In many ways, Trump has driven the Russians and the Chinese together. Do you think now that Trump is threatening to do to China what he just did to Mexico, even though it turned out to be completely fraudulent, but now he thinks he's done such a great job of getting the Mexicans to cry uncle and accede to his tariff deal that he's going to now turn his attention to China and make them cry uncle? What do you think his chances are?
Well, look, I think it's been clear since day one that that's exactly what President Trump wants to do when it comes to China. He has been longing for a deal to address some of the economic issues and disparities in the trade relationship since day one. During 2017, his first year in office, he tried the charm offensive with Xi Jinping. It didn't work, and so he does what Trump usually does, which is reverse course and do a 180 and go to the trade war. And we've been on that path, obviously, ever since. And so I think that what, though, the goal for the president is, and always has been, is to get some sort of a deal, some sort of a piece of paper that he can hold up in the Rose Garden to reporters and claim that he's succeeded and, you know, won a victory with China. And so at the end of the day, I think the question is, what does President Trump think that he needs to do to get that deal? Right now, obviously, he thinks that he needs to continue upping the ante on the tariffs against China. But the question will be, you know, when does President Trump think that that no longer is working for him? He decided to turn on the dime with North Korea, obviously, and to, you know, agree to diplomacy. He's done the same repeatedly with Mexico, obviously, talks a big game and then immediately backs down, claiming victory. So the question is if and when he'll decide that he wants to do the same thing with Xi Jinping, and maybe it'll be at the upcoming G20 meeting.
If she shows up, and Trump's saying if he doesn't show up, he's going to ramp up the tariffs.
Right. And I think that that's honestly a lot of just bluster from Trump. I've heard nothing to indicate that Xi Jinping will not come to the G20. This is a meeting that he usually attends, and it seems to me like he'll be there, and I think the chances are highly likely that the two would meet.
So, again, I'm speaking with Michael Fuchs, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who serves as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs and was Special Advisor to the Secretary of State for Strategic Dialogues. He also served as a member of the Secretary's Policy Planning Staff, where he worked on a diverse set of issues and initiatives, including the State Department's response to the Arab Spring, cybersecurity, and the development of a U.S. government strategy to prevent and respond to mass atrocities. And he co-authored The Survival and Success of Liberty, a Democracy Agenda for U.S. Foreign Policy with Morton Halperin. So, Michael Fuchs, what's your sense then of when, if you use, as you just did, North Korea as an example of Trump's diplomatic success, in quotes? We're just learning today, of course, that I guess the overheads have picked up many more execution sites now in North Korea. We know about the one at the Mirin Air Base outside of Pyongyang, where apparently Kim Jong-un watches the assassination of his rivals or people that fall asleep during his long speeches, where they blow them apart with anti-aircraft guns. So does that ever get through to, I know there was an amazing exchange in a House hearing with Pompeo testifying, where I think a former State Department guy who's now a U.S. congressman was grilling Pompeo about, you know, Trump's love affair with Kim Jong-un, saying, you know, what's there to like? What's there to like about this guy? And you could see that Pompeo was just getting furious, having to defend the indefensible. So how do you defend the indefensible in terms of, he got a bogus deal with Mexico that he's bragging about, even though the New York Times exposed it as a fraud. And if he does the same with China, when do the chickens come home to roost?
Well, look, the way you engage with North Korea is obviously not the way that President Trump has done it. The president has encountered countless mistakes, I would say, in the way he's approached his diplomacy with North Korea, from rushing into a first summit without preparation to rushing into a second summit without preparation, all the way, and absolutely including at the top of that list, his repeated praise for Kim Jong-un, to the point at which even today, I believe, President Trump remarked to reporters about the reports that Kim Jong-un's half-brother might have been somehow working with the CIA, and President Trump said that nothing like that would ever happen under his auspices, indicating somehow that he would never try to have the CIA get intelligence sources close to Kim Jong-un, which of course is insane. But I think that the difficulty in this whole situation, of course, is that while we all agree that President Trump has sort of continually shot himself in the foot when it comes to diplomatic efforts with North Korea and continues to do so in the way that he praises this awful, awful dictator, the notion of diplomacy between the United States and North Korea is still necessary. It's still something that we, frankly, need to do. Now, it's hard to consider exactly what President Trump is doing to be good or substantive or real diplomacy. But it should not let us stand in the way. It should not stand in the way of recognizing that engagement between the two countries is, frankly, the only way we're going to solve this problem. I just, frankly, wish we had a president that was able to actually conduct that diplomacy.
So one of the odd things about the U.S. and its position in the world is that the U.S. has been the global hegemon since 1945, although China is certainly on the rise, and arguably the U.S. is on the decline in terms of its certainly its global respect, thanks to Trump. But there's always been a disconnect between America's power and the lack of interest that the average American has in foreign policy. And I read a very interesting piece in at CNN yesterday by a former National Security Council guy that you may know, Rosenthal, D.J. Rosenthal. He was on the National Security Council under Obama for cybersecurity and counterterrorism. And he made the case that the good news is that because Trump is so incompetent, erratic, and mercurial, that the rest of the world, particularly our allies, don't take him seriously. So, you know, that's a good thing. Now, I don't know whether it's a good thing in terms of our enemies. What's your response to that idea?
Well, I have to say that I disagree with it. I think it's a terrible thing for us. I think it's, you know, the ways in which it's terrible, I could probably go on for quite some time. I think it makes both allies, in particular allies, lose faith in the United States, in our credibility, in our consistency, in this, frankly, the strength of our own democratic system. And I also think it allows adversaries to see weakness in the United States. If you are a adversary and you think that the president of the United States is a buffoon, it seems to me like that's a pretty big problem. Some of the adversaries have learned how to play President Trump. And so I think, again, the problem here is that President Trump, just by – there are lots of people who go around sort of trying to explain away President Trump's tweets and his off-the-cuff remarks about things and point to what they – call quote-unquote real policy, you know, being implemented by professionals in the cabinet agencies around the world. But the reality is that we can't discount how important and how much of an impact what the president says and the way he conducts himself has on American relations with countries, allies and adversaries alike around the world. Those countries spend tremendous time and energy, resources, frankly, analyzing, trying to figure out what the United States is doing. And the best source that they have for that is exactly what the president of the United States does. And it certainly doesn't help us if our best argument is that to foreign allies, for instance, that they should not look at the president's Twitter feed, but in fact focus on what, say, a lower official is saying. That doesn't really help the U.S. case, I feel like.
So what do you think our allies, let alone our enemies, how would they respond to the fact that Trump is doing a state visit to the UK, America's closest ally, and 1:30 in the morning after spending the day with the Queen and the royal family, he tweets out at 1:30 in the morning an attack on Bette Midler. I mean, what do you think they think of that?
Your reaction, I think, sums it up. It's, you know, laughable in a very sad and unfortunate way. You know, I think that some of our allies they're used to this by now, 2+ years in. Doesn't make it any easier for them to bear, but it's sort of baked in, and it just significantly lowers the expectations for the United States around the world. You know, when President Trump was there at that trip to France commemorating the anniversary, 75th anniversary of D-Day, and he gave a speech where he was able to more or less read prepared remarks, which of course is something that the president doesn't do very often. He seemed to get praise from a number of corners there, and I think that's frankly how many of our allies look, is that they recognize that despite what they feel about the president privately and the ways in which their countries might unfortunately be hedging against an uncertain United States, publicly, their expectations have lowered to the point where if the president can come and he can read remarks that sound like the type of thing that a normal president of the United States should say, then we'll take it. And that's good enough.
Well, just in the last minute, Michael Fuchs, given that people tend not to pay much attention to foreign policy, and it's not a big issue, and of course we're in a current presidential race, even though it's the elections aren't until November of next year, obviously domestic politics take precedent. But do you think that the fact that Trump is so undignified and so embarrassing that a number of Americans, perhaps a majority, are troubled by that? There's always been a certain dignity associated with being the head of state, and Trump has certainly blown that up.
Yeah, I think that that's right. And I think that there are fundamentally, you know, there are a variety of different ways in which the American people relate to foreign policy. You know, one of them, I think, is the way in which specific policies impact their lives. So things like trade policies, the current trade war, issues like immigration, issues like wars, obviously. Specific policies, and they think about how does it impact them directly. There's also, though, a broader sense that's obviously a lot more intangible, and it gets at the point you're raising, which is how do you feel as an American about your country and its place in the world? And the symbol that is most conspicuous to Americans is the president of the United States. And the way in which the president conducts himself or herself is important. And so, again, while it may be difficult for pollsters and others to see, you know, how important that is for a voter, I definitely think it matters. And you can see Americans say in polls in recent last couple of years how they don't like it when, for instance, the president attacks allies and where our allies don't respect us nearly enough. That's something that Americans respond to. The question, again, at the end of the day, of course, is where do these issues rank in terms of how important voters consider them to be on their lists of priorities?
Well, Michael Fuchs, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
No, thank you. It's my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Fuchs, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia and Pacific Affairs and was Special Advisor to the Secretary of State for Strategic Dialogues. He also served as a member of the Secretary's Policy Planning Staff, and he co-authored The Survival and the Success of Liberty, a Democracy Agenda for U.S. Foreign Policy with Morton Halperin. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking to somebody who served on the National Security Council and as counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee about the fact that there is no such thing as a deep state, which should have become clear to everybody when we learned Robert Mueller brought a pencil to a gunfight.
Depends on who. I'm gonna get you on a slow boat to China, all to myself. Get you and keep you in my arms evermore. Leave all the others waiting on a faraway shore. Your destination, College Town.
La, 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 la.
The Southern University System.
La, 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 la.
Education's high.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report, who was a former senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, the executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. He recently testified before the House Oversight Committee on Economic and Consumer Policy about the for-profit college industry and how it has been empowered by the U.S. Department of Education under Secretary Betsy DeVos. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Halperin.
Thank you, Ian.
So, David, the New York Times just carried a story on Monday about Diane Ower Jones, Betsy DeVos's top higher education aide. She claims to have blown the whistle on Career Education Corp, one of these predatory for-profit colleges. But nevertheless, the CEO of this same company bragged to Wall Street of big increases in profits of late under the DeVos regime. So what's explain that disconnect, if you will.
Well, Diane Ower Jones worked for the Department of Education under President Bush. And then when the Obama administration started, she went to work for the for-profit college industry. And from 2010 to 2015, she was senior vice president at Career Education Corporation, one of the worst predatory colleges that has consistently lied to students, ripped them off, left them worse than when they started. Now, I have heard before that she's told people at the department that she blew the whistle on bad practices there. I don't know if it's true that there was a sort of a one-liner in the New York Times story that wasn't followed up on. I'm sure Congress will want to follow up because, as you said, under Secretary DeVos and Ms. Jones's policies of getting rid of all accountability for this industry, Career Education Corporation is bragging that it's doing better than ever, and that's bad news for students. She also worked for other bad predatory colleges as a consultant, and they're also doing well. So Diane Jones has a record, in addition to getting rid of accountability for these schools, of not telling the truth, including in the congressional hearing where I testified, and she testified separately. So it's a mess. It is basically this administration, the Trump administration, Betsy DeVos, siding with the worst scammers in the education industry and continuing to ruin the lives of students.
So what's going on with Betsy DeVos then? She's supposed to be a good Christian. She wears a Christianity on her sleeve. And what is Christian about ripping off young, aspiring Americans who want a better education in order to get a better job, a lot of them veterans? How does a Christian recognize the cruelty of saddling these young Americans with a lifetime of debt and a worthless diploma?
Well, I'm no expert on Christian theology. It doesn't seem like something Jesus would have supported. But I can tell you this, it's not very Republican in the sense that Republicans are supposed to be against waste, fraud, and abuse with taxpayer dollars. That's what I went in and said to the Oversight Committee, and the Republicans were listening. I said three things that all members of Congress ought to agree on. We're against waste, fraud, and abuse. If we invest money, there ought to be performance standards to make sure we're getting what we pay for, and that government programs shouldn't leave beneficiaries, the intended beneficiaries, worse off than when they started. Those are all things that should come straight out of the mouths of Republicans and certainly have for years in arguing against all kinds of federal programs. But when it comes to this special program, where most of the money goes to wealthy, Wall Street firms and private equity firms, they seem thrilled with the idea because those same firms are donors to those same Republican members. But the Republican members on the committee to which I testified, the House Oversight Subcommittee, actually seemed to be listening and asking me questions and even came up and talked with me during the break. The Republican, the person who's most enthralled to this industry is Virginia Fox, who's on the House Education Committee, former chair. She sort of walked into the hearing, sat down, and were whispering things in the ear of these members. But they weren't necessarily listening to her because they heard something there, which is the lives of veterans, single moms, immigrants, and others were being ruined by these schools. And to their credit, they actually were paying attention.
And, of course, Virginia Fox from North Carolina is an arch reactionary. And the fact that they take money from this for-profit college industry, that's taxpayer money. This is what I don't understand. If we have turned our legislators into telemarketers, which appears to be the case, they spend their days dialing for dollars. Isn't there a law against taking taxpayer money and having it recycled back to you to get you reelected? is then, I guess there isn't a law against that.
Not a law against that. And obviously defense contractors, I mean, it's not the corporations themselves who are making the campaign contributions. It's individuals who work there, mostly executives. And that's a hard thing and a difficult issue to say that we could somehow ban that because they could be giving for all kinds of reasons. But we know that the lobbyists and executives there are giving money in order to get what they want. When Mitt Romney ran against Obama, he praised for-profit colleges. It turned out the colleges he was praising not only were donors to his campaign, but in fact he was invested in those very companies. So the kind of corruption that we've seen is predates Trump, and in fact many Democrats have been enthralled to this industry. But to the credit of the Democratic leadership in Congress, increasingly the Democrats have been a strong voice for students and taxpayers. Maxine Waters from Los Angeles has been all along an advocate for students on this industry, but quite a few others, Elizabeth Warren, Dick Durbin, have become incredible champions for students on this, but we still haven't won because the president of Trump University is now president of the United States.
And again, I'm speaking with David Halpin, as a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. And he recently testified before the House Oversight Subcommittee on Economic and Consumer Policy about the for-profit college industry and how it has been empowered by the U.S. Department of Education under Secretary Betsy DeVos. So given that all problems go back to the Orange Duce, as some people call him, in the Oval Office. What did you think yesterday about John Dean's testimony before the House Judiciary Committee?
It was truth. It was saying that there needs to be accountability for corruption in the White House and from somebody who lived that experience. But we had a much more principled Congress back then. Republicans on the committee were willing to look past partisanship and decide what was in the interest of the country. Frankly, we had a better president. Richard Nixon was much more of a patriot in the end, saw the writing on the wall and was nowhere near as corrupt. He wasn't in it for the money. He was in it to stay president. And Donald Trump is really just about, obviously, his naked need for attention and approval we see every day in every tweet, but it's also about personal corruption and all the foreign leaders and conservative activists who have their events at the Trump Hotel and the money goes to the president. So John Dean was there as a truth teller, and of course he was therefore predictably savaged by Republican henchmen like Matt Gaetz.
Well, to my mind, the way to get rid of Trump is this is an anomaly, Trump, who was elected largely because he got $6 billion worth of free advertising from the mainstream media. And he is a reality TV star, and he governs by reality TV stunts, as we saw with Mexico over the weekend.
Yep.
So that is a given. Is it possible that the same reality TV star who got elected using reality TV techniques, which is clearly what he knows and where his skills are, he's absolutely hopeless at doing anything else, but he's very good at manipulating the news cycle. Is it possible that he could be brought down by the same reality TV? Because that's what I think is going on here. If you get people like Don McGahn to testify and people who spent any time close to Trump, they all hate him. They all know he's insane. Anybody who spends a few minutes with him realizes, my God, this guy's nuts. If you could get a camera into the Oval Office for 5 minutes, it would be the end of Trump. So the next best thing would be to get people to testify like Michael Cohen did. That
Yep.
really got under Trump's skin, and he knows that's where he's vulnerable. So do you think that that can happen? Because I don't see Gerald Nadler getting anywhere near what's necessary to educate the public via television testimony about who this insane person is in the Oval Office.
I don't know. I mean, the Michael Cohen testimony was terrific for all of us who know that Trump is a crook, but it kind of came and went. If you had a parade of more people who were willing to do that, yes, I think that would help, but I'm not sure who those people are. I think Don McGahn is still, you know, wants to be a loyal soldier to some extent to the Republican Party. A camera in the Oval Office showing what a complete idiot and crook Trump is would also be awesome, although we had the Access Hollywood tape, and that came and went. And Trump was elected president. So I think what you need is someone who like Hillary Clinton, was willing to be in Trump's face, but unlike Hillary Clinton, can really be presented as a champion of the people, someone who's actually fighting for working people. Hillary Clinton would have, but she just didn't seem like it. And also, I think the number one thing in my recipe for beating Trump is one word, which is weak. Donald Trump is weak. He's not dangerous. That sounds like a James Bond villain. He's weak. He never, as you said, doesn't accomplish anything, just a bunch of passive-aggressive tweets. He can tear down things like the Paris Agreement, but he can't actually build anything. Today he held the Mexican Agreement, apparently, in his hand. It turned out to be a blank piece of paper, like you said. It's just reality TV. He's the weakest president we've ever had, and if you stand on a stage and say that to him, I think at some point he starts to crumble.
Well, there's an interesting piece I read yesterday at CNN by somebody from the National Security Council under Obama working on counterterrorism, who said that actually it's a virtue that Trump is so incompetent and so weak, because the rest of the world leaders know that, particularly our allies, and they just don't listen to him. But of course, but our enemies benefit, don't they? I mean, Russia and China benefit enormously. Russia and China are now new best friends. That's the opposite of what Nixon organized in 1972 with Mao, where the U.S. was in the catbird seat playing the USSR off against the PRC.
Yes, it's dangerous that Trump is weak, but we still have a lot of assets and sort of things that... I mean, there's also the possibility that Trump will act like a madman that does probably help protect us at this point. But we also have, we have armed forces all over the world. We have skilled people in diplomacy, and Trump can't undermine all of that at once. But yes, it's dangerous. Every minute he's president, our national security is at greater risk than it's ever been, in recent memory. So I think. What we need to do is impress upon people of goodwill that, yes, that this is a ticking time bomb, and we need to get rid of him. But unfortunately, as I've always said, the Republican Party's mantra is rich people and angry people coming together, and there's enough rich people and angry people who have an interest between making money and being racist and Donald Trump still being president. So the key is to outvote him, turn out enough people to outvote him.
And there's a third constituency, which is the sort of Opus Dei lunatic wing of Catholicism run by Leonard Leo, who puts up this list. And Leonard Leo's best friend, Bill Barr, wants to be on the Supreme Court and wants this list of judges appointed to the courts, the federal courts. And I'm sure that's why he's rolling over backwards to accommodate Trump. But, at the end of the day, you worked in national security on the National Security Council and also as a counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. So you're in a position, David Halpern, to know that there's no such thing as a deep state. It's a myth. I mean, I wish we had a deep state. I wish they could get rid of this guy. But look at the exemplar of the deep state, Robert Mueller. Look at what he accomplished, or I should say what he failed to accomplish.
Yeah, he's a gentleman. The deep state is things like putting up a pride flag during Pride Month when Michael Pompeo says, he doesn't like that. That's the kind of resistance that we have. I think, though, as I've probably said before on your show, I think we'll see what kind of state we have, deep or not, if Trump loses the election and then announces that the election was rigged and that he's not going to leave. That's when I think we're going to see, and that's why I wish we still had General Mattis and some genuinely quasi-independent people, because then we're going to see what, potentially, what our troops do, what our Secret Service, what our FBI does to get that orange blob out of the building.
Right, but we don't have General Mattis anymore, or even General Kelly. And
yeah, those were semi-responsible. Although Kelly was pretty awful,
he was pretty awful. But the point I want to make is that what we have now is these are the people that surround Trump now. You got this horrible little sycophantic enabler and total toady Mick Mulvaney. Right. Then you've got the family. You got Jared and Ivanka, and then you've got Miller, and then you got Brad Paisley, his campaign guy. That's all you've got.
Correct.
Mnuchin too, yeah. But that's it. That's the inner circle. Those are the people. Yep. That's our guardrail protecting our democracy from a lunatic.
That's right. You have Chris Wray at the FBI who remarkably, he could have put somebody a lot worse in there, like Giuliani. He's a career person. You have the Joint Chiefs of Staff, some of them quite, serious people that care about our country. I just think I don't know what to say if because the trend is anyone, as you suggest, who's quasi-independent, quasi-integrity gets replaced by a toady. And that just has happened time and again. And so yes, 8 years of this, God knows what will happen if they'll bring in Don Jr. and Eric Giuliani, people who are only about loyalty to the president, then it does get more grim. Bill Barr is the worst example of that. He's supposed to be a symbol of impartiality of justice, and he's just basically become the Roy Cohn that Trump was looking for. I don't know if the public cares about all this intrigue. What they ought to care about is things like the fact that the tax cut only went to the rich, that Trump is trying to get rid of their health care, that Trump is obviously ignoring the dangers of climate change when they're seeing it now in their daily lives as starkly as they're seeing things like, underemployment and low wages with all the extreme weather that we have. So it's somebody who is issue-oriented, future-oriented. It's our only hope is these people who see Trump as their savior in one way or another, that they're just simply outvoted by someone who really can turn out the electorate. I can tell you that I will be doing everything I can I could show you the emails last time when I tried to help the campaign, but they didn't like my ideas for it. But I will be doing everything I can to help defeat Trump, because that's our only chance really to turn this country around right now.
Well, David Halpern, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with David Halpern, who's a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. And he recently testified before the House Oversight Subcommittee on Economic and Consumer Policy about the for-profit college industry and how it has been empowered by the U.S. Department of Education under Secretary Betsy DeVos. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back hearing from an Israeli activist who believes in a one-state solution with the creation of one democratic state with equal rights for Palestinians and Israelis. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Miko Peled, who is a Israeli writer and activist dedicated to tearing down the separation wall and advocating the creation of one democratic state with equal rights for Israelis and Palestinians. He travels regularly to Palestine and Israel, where he speaks, works with the popular resistance, and has been arrested several times by the Israeli authorities for his activities. He blogs at mikopeled.com and is the author of The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. And he has two articles at Mint Press News, For the U.S. and Israel, Iran Works Best as a Perpetual Threat, and Netanyahu is Gambling on New Elections to Stay in Power. Welcome to Background Briefing, Miko Peled.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Well, thank you. Now, you just got back from Israel and Palestine. How do you get into Palestine? You have to go through Israel, obviously.
Well, to me, it's all Palestine. I refuse to acknowledge the name Israel. I think acknowledging the name Israel is legitimizing the occupation of Palestine and the oppression and the apartheid regime that has been part of Palestine for 71 years. So when I say Palestine, I mean the entire country. And I get in just like anybody else. I have Israeli citizenship, and I get in with my privilege as an Israeli.
Well, but you've got to be an extreme minority. How many Israelis think of their country as Palestine?
Including me?
Yeah, three or four.
Yeah, not many. There's a handful of Israelis who are activists who are, you know, who voice their opinions as on this matter and feel as I do. Not many.
Right. Well, what is your sense then of whether your political platform and program will ever materialize? I mean, most liberals around the world and in Israel, even though they're an increasing minority, believe in a two-state solution.
Well, people can believe whatever they want. Some people believe that the world is flat. The reality is that all of Palestine is occupied. It's been occupied. The vast majority of the country was occupied in 1948. The remainder was occupied in 1967. Israel has built towns and roads and shopping malls and everything else over all of Palestine. But the fact still remains. So in other words, so it's all one state. It's all one country. Governed by a racist apartheid regime, which gives me privilege over the Palestinians, who are the indigenous people. Now, at the same time, we have to remember that up until May 15th, 1948, the country was called Palestine. And if you've seen Nur Masalha's, the story of Nur Masalha's new book, Palestine, A 4,000-Year History, she shows very clearly that the country was called and referred to as Palestine for close to 4,000 years. So it's an episode, it's a regime. I think Israel is a regime, it's not a legitimate state, just like apartheid was a regime in South Africa. And every effort must be made to bring it down and replace it with a democracy with equal rights. The fact that all of Palestine is one state is already a reality. The issue is, do we accept it as it is, which is a violent, racist regime? Or do we strive to bring it into change it into a democracy with equal rights?
Well, let's deal with the reality of Israel today and the articles that you've written at Mint Press News, Mika Peled, for the U.S. and Israel, Iran works best as a perpetual threat, and Netanyahu is gambling on new elections to stay in power. Netanyahu, of course, has, along with the country, has turned to the right. And now Netanyahu and Trump are best friends. And I believe most Israelis love Trump. Is that right?
Yes, that's all true. In the last elections, which were held just a few months ago, the winner was very clear that in order to win, you have to go as far right as possible and to prove that no one is to the right of you and to accuse anybody else that might be challenging you that they are left. That was the entire campaign of every single political party other than one or two small ones. And Netanyahu, of course, you know, as we all might recall, he made an alliance with really the neo-Nazi Kahanist parties. And you can't really go any farther to the right than that. And of course, ideologically, he agrees with them. So there was no problem there. He of course has great relationship with Donald Trump, which I think is his main strength. He has been a very accomplished prime minister for the last 10 years. He's done a great deal of what Israelis would consider important and positive things for the state of Israel. Probably the main one is the U.S. recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of the state of Israel and moving its embassy there. And so this is a reality in which he decides to, you know, give it another shot because the majority that he won was not enough to create a coalition government. And he's in a political reality where obviously there are quite a few politicians within the state of Israel who want to see him out of the picture, which I think is really why they did not go into a coalition with him. I think both Lieberman on the right and Benny Gantz, who pretends to be center but is really as probably as right wing as anybody, They just don't want to sit with Netanyahu. They want to see him out of the picture. So he took this risk, and we'll see what happens. I think this election will either bring him back very strong or eliminate him from the picture altogether. I would tend to think he will come back strong, and all of these guys are going to be working for him.
Well, just today, Netanyahu's son, Yair Netanyahu, was on TV in Israel calling Trump a rock star in Israel. And again, I'm speaking with Micha Peled, who's an Israeli writer and activist dedicated to tearing down the separation wall and advocating the creation of one democratic state with equal rights for Israelis and Palestinians. He travels regularly to Palestine and Israel, where he speaks, works with the popular resistance, and has been arrested several times by the Israeli authorities for his activities. He blogs at MichaPeled.com and is the author of The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. And he has two articles at Mint Press News, For the U.S. and Israel, Iran Works Best as a Perpetual Threat, and Netanyahu's Gambling on New Elections to Stay in Power. So tell us about Lieberman's move, the former foreign minister Lieberman, who's basically pulled out of the coalition, which has forced Netanyahu into a new election. What's his agenda?
Well, his personal agenda, I think, is to get rid of Netanyahu and replace him. The story or the excuse that is being used, or the main excuse that's being used, is the draft law. You know, for the last 10 years or so, there's been a break in the status quo with the new law that they're trying to put in place, which will force the ultra-Orthodox Jews into the army. Since the creation of the State of Israel until a few years ago, there was the status quo was that they were exempt. Now this has become a very hot political issue, one that they cannot agree on and one that has caused a great deal of trouble. And they're trying to force a community which does not want to be in the army into the military. Netanyahu needs the Orthodox parties within the Knesset for his coalition. And they, of course, oppose the law. And then he also needs Lieberman, who supports the law. So this was a breaking point. And Lieberman said he won't sit in the government unless there is a guarantee that the law remains, or a certain version of the law that he wants becomes law. So it all fell apart. Normally, the head of the next largest political party would try to put together a coalition. And they said that they were quite happy to sit with Netanyahu's Likud party in a coalition, but not with Netanyahu. So you have them on the one side not wanting to sit with Netanyahu, Lieberman on the other side obviously not wanting to sit with Netanyahu. So rather than allow the process to continue and let the second largest party try to put together a coalition, he called for re-elections and succeeded. And the bet that he's making is that the electorate will choose him again.
Well, I was just watching a really good Israeli miniseries, I think on Amazon or Netflix, I can't remember which one, about a young Russian who moves into an apartment building in a neighborhood of ultra-Orthodox, and it's kind of Romeo and Juliet story about a love affair between this secular young Russian emigre and an Orthodox girl. And a lot of my Israeli friends say that if ever the Palestinian-Israeli situation is settled, which is a big if, Israel will turn against itself in the sense that the secular and the religious are absolutely incompatible. Is that true in the context of what you're talking about here?
Well, I think there's a larger picture here. The larger picture here that you've got the State of Israel, which is an inherently secular, racist entity, which hates the Orthodox Jews and hates the Arabs and tries to get rid of the Arabs and secular the Orthodox Jews. These has been the two biggest national projects of the Zionist movement, to secularize the Orthodox and to get rid of the Arabs. And so they find themselves today really a regime that is made of mostly immigrants standing and opposing the two indigenous communities of Palestine, which are the Orthodox community, which predates the State of Israel, and the Palestinians, of course. So the only way that the Palestinian issue is going to be resolved is when this regime collapses and a real democracy with equal rights takes its place. At least that's how I see it. Now, when that happens, a democracy with equal rights will allow, hopefully, everybody to live as they are. And all this harassment and persecution of the Orthodox community by the Zionists will end. So it's true that there is, you know, the Zionists are inherently secular, and the Israelis are inherently a secular people. The ultra-Orthodox are ultra-Orthodox Jews, and they've lived this way for a very long time, and they wish to maintain their tradition, they wish to maintain their way of life. And the state of Israel is investing millions upon millions upon millions of dollars in programs and incentives and bribes to try to get this community to become more secular and more accepting of Zionism, because basically the ultra-Orthodox community opposes Zionism altogether as well. And so this is a struggle that goes on, but I think once the regime comes to an end, which is what I believe will happen, then these problems will come to kind of a natural solution, because there, if you have a democracy with equal rights and you respect everybody's right to be who they are and everybody's identity and religion, then you solve all of these problems.
Well, Bill Clinton got into a lot of trouble a while back by saying the obvious, that Israel has moved to the right, and he attributed that to the influx of immigrants from the former Soviet Union, who, all having experienced communism, hated any vestige of socialism, which was the original people that founded Israel with the kibbutzes, etc., and they're all pretty much gone. So how do you reconcile that split when you've got right-wing Israelis of Russian descent and right-wing ultra-Orthodox? Aren't they politically on the right?
Yeah, again, that's a little too simplistic. Israel was founded after a massive campaign of ethnic cleansing, horrifying massacres, and the destruction of hundreds and towns of villages of the indigenous population. Now, granted, the government that ran Israel for the first 3 decades or so called themselves left socialists. But in terms of their treatment of the Palestinians, and in terms of the treatment of the Orthodox community too, I should say, but mostly the Palestinians, you could not be farther to the right. So to claim that Israel has gone to the right is true perhaps in some senses, but really how farther to the right can you be after you've destroyed a complete country and built on top of it? So on that issue, you know, it's not like the governments that came before or earlier in the history of the state of Israel were somehow more liberal and more open and more tolerant of the native population. They destroyed and killed and massacred and expelled and did horrifying things. And the current government that we see today is the perfect continuation of those policies. There really is very little difference. Blaming the Russians is a little unfair, I think, because the state of Israel has, on this issue, has been the same. There is a shift to the right in terms of economics, in terms of neoliberalism and stuff like that. So, but again, any socialism that existed within the state of Israel was only applied to the Jewish community, only applied to the Jews. The Arabs, the Arabs were a completely different community. They still are, and are treated very differently than the Jews. So it's kind of a national socialism, if anything. It wasn't really socialism. And so to blame the immigrants, you know, it's not completely fair. Now, the right-left gets a little bit confused when you're in Palestine, you know, when you talk about the Israeli regime. Originally, and to this day, to a large degree, the ultra-Orthodox community opposed the creation of a Jewish state, of the Zionist state. It is, according to them, it is in violation of Jewish law, which states that Jews are not allowed to return to the Holy Land, are not allowed to have sovereignty in the Holy Land. Now, over the decades, the Zionists were able to bribe and convince and pay and, you know, certain parts of the ultra-Orthodox community. But when you walk around Mea Shearim, which is one of the oldest Jewish communities in Jerusalem, which predates the state of Israel, you see Palestinian flags and signs saying, "We are not Israelis. A good Jew will never be a Zionist." So you've got all of this in the mix. And then you've got among the different ultra-Orthodox groups, you've got different views on this issue. You've got different ways. A lot of them don't vote. They boycott the vote. Some do vote. Some will go with Netanyahu. But a lot of it has to do with funding. What they want is they want funding for their learning institutions. And anybody who will give them that funding and will allow them the freedom that they want in terms of education will get their vote.
Well, is this to say then, to your mind then, because I knew Yitzhak Rabin, and of course he was assassinated by a right-winger, would Israel have been better off had Rabin not been assassinated?
What we see today is the direct result of the plan that Rabin and Peres concocted, what was called the Oslo Accords. What we see today is the result of that. The Oslo Accords were a recipe to allow Israel to gain more control, more land, or more land and more control of the resources and the people, and to push Palestinians out and allow them just a small symbolic kind of autonomy and recognition. You know, a small space in Ramallah with a guy they can call a president, and a little one in Bethlehem and a couple of other places. And what we see today is really the result of Oslo. So when people say the peace failed or the Oslo Accords failed, it's not true. The Oslo Accords and that particular plan, which is really not a peace plan, but that particular plan, I think, succeeded tremendously because it did exactly what it was designed to do. Israel today has much more control over the Palestinians. Palestinians have much less control over their lives and their resources and so forth, even though they now have a president and they have ambassadors and they have all the symbols of a state, but they are as occupied, as oppressed, and killed with ease as ever before.
Well, but the Israeli right, Netanyahu and all of his even further to the right coalition members, they don't say it, but they don't have an end game, because their end game, as far as anybody can tell, is they hope that the Palestinians will just go away and slink off into Jordan. So I can't see how you can make the case that Rabin's is no different from Netanyahu.
He's no different from Netanyahu. Absolutely not. On this issue, there was absolutely no difference whatsoever. One of them, or perhaps if there is a difference, one of them, which is Netanyahu, just dropped the mask and the pretense of caring about peace. And the other one went through the motions to create some kind of a semblance of an agreement and a peaceful agreement with the Palestinians. But there's absolutely no difference between them. Now, when there is an element among those who are to the extreme right, these neo-Nazi, neo-fascist Kahana types, who today are in the Knesset, who today have a voice and have a great deal of legitimacy. And they want to see the Golden Dome in Jerusalem replaced with the Jewish temple. And they have programs that train young men and women to push for that goal. And these are state-sponsored programs. In other words, many of the young people who do not serve in the military and do kind of a civil service or a civilian kind of national service, they can opt for a program in which they learn about how the temple will be built and the sacrifices and so forth that will take place. And we're not talking about a few fringe lunatics. We're talking about tens and tens and tens of thousands of people who this has almost become a mainstream idea. So they've got this other agenda, and like one of them said, Smotrich, who's in the Knesset, he said that they want to see a day when halakha, you know, the days of that, you know, Israel is run by Jewish law and all kinds of things like that. So that's where they're going. Mm-hmm. But the thing is with these groups, this more radical right wing group of people, is if we look at the history of how Israel developed, they always get what they fight for. You know, every single settlement started like that.
Well, they're certainly getting a lot of help from Trump and Kushner, et cetera. But I thank you. We've run out of time, Mika Peled, but I thank you very much for joining us here today. And as you yourself have agreed, there are not many people in Israel that share your beliefs, even though there are, of course, a lot of Israeli Arabs who are citizens of Israel. And you're saying is you can build upon that. Is that what you're saying just in the last couple of seconds?
Well, they are third-class citizens. They're not citizens as I am a citizen. So I think, no, I'm not building on Arabs becoming citizens under the Zionist regime. I'm talking about all Israelis and Palestinians becoming completely equal citizens without the privilege that I, as a Jew today, have in Palestine.
Well, Micha Pelela, thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Micha Pelela, who's an Israeli writer and activist dedicated to tearing down the separation wall and advocating the creation of one democratic state with equal rights for Israelis and Palestinians. He travels regularly to Palestine and Israel, where he speaks, works with the popular resistance, and has been arrested several times by the Israeli authorities for his activities. He blogs at michapelela.com and is the author of The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, and he has two articles at Mint Press News, For the U.S. and Israel, Iran Works Best as a Perpetual Threat, and Netanyahu's Gambling on New Elections to Stay in Power. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.